You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello, everybody. Happy New Year, and welcome back to the latest episode of the City of Man podcast, the first episode for 2018 and our 51st episode overall, which is kind of hard to believe. I am Ed Song. I'm an associate professor of philosophy at Westmont College, which is still in Santa Barbara, California, though there were times at which it wasn't entirely clear whether we would still be in Santa Barbara, California. In the foothills of Montecito. And I'm joined by Coyle Neal, who is an assistant professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University, which is still in Bolivar, Missouri, isn't it, Coyle? No earthquakes.
It is. It's under some snow, but other than that, it's still here.
I mean, is that tornado country? It's not earthquake country. What?
You know, we are earthquake country, although I don't think there's been one here since, you know, the 1800s. We are technically in tornado country, but Bolivar, like the town itself, is in this weird kind of weather shadow. So like tornadoes tend to go north of us and south of us. So the town, you know, 20 minutes north of us gets a lot of tornadoes. The town 20 minutes south of us gets a lot of tornadoes. Bolivar gets, you know, maybe one a decade, if even that. So yeah, it's an odd little town in terms of its climate.
Have you ever lived through a tornado there or anywhere else or any other kind of extreme weather event?
Well, so extreme weather event in the sense that I grew up where there were lots and lots of blizzards. So yes, you know, southern Montana, northern Wyoming.
And forest fires too, probably.
Yeah, lots. Well, grassland fires. So in some ways worse because they move so much faster. And then I lived in D.C. the year they had the, you know, like 50 inches of snow and, you know, three storms about a week apart.
Yeah.
Totaling 50 inches of snow. So I was there for that. I have slept through a couple of tornadoes. One in Montana, because of course, living in rural Montana, there are no sirens. So, if you're asleep, you're asleep. Here, there have been a couple of times that the tornado sirens have gone off, and we've just slept through them. So, yes, but never in any life endangering sense. I think the closest I've ever come to having my life be in danger because of any kind of extreme weather was a wildfire back in 1988 that took out Yellowstone Park and most of Montana, and it was sort of right across the river from where we lived. But more on that as we get into the episode. I don't want to steal any thunder. How did we get on that?
I just asked you about natural disasters. You know, it's a crazy thing. I mean, obviously, we get on this topic because Westmont is in Montecito. Montecito, I think, has been in the national news twice now for related reasons. The largest wildfire in California history, at least since they started measuring these things sometime in the early 20th century, happened, the Thomas Fire. It's crazy. I think at its longest, it's like over 60 miles long, stretching from, it started in Ventura, which is the city, it's a 30-minute drive from here, and then just blew west and came right up to the doorstep of Westmont College. I mean, literally, actually, if you go behind the northernmost dorm, the fire, I mean, it burns right up to the edge of the dorm. The good thing for us is that because there was so much time, I mean, I guess the fire had started 2 weeks before it got to our neck of the woods. Like, every firefighter west of the Mississippi, I think, was in Santa Barbara County. There were like 8,000 firefighters, and they were actually able to protect structures door to door, which you almost never get to do just because wildfires are wild and they happen quickly. And so there was that, and we are now just sort of still in the recovery phase from the mudslide or debris flow that happened in the aftermath of that. And in both instances, Westmont's campus is totally perfectly fine. Like, even the day of the flood, you wouldn't have known that anything had happened. You know, we even put a bucket out just to see how much rain fell. And I don't think there are more than 2 inches of rain in that bucket. The problem was that the rate of rainfall, there was some insane thing where like an inch dropped in 20 minutes.
Right. And the wildfires had burned off all the ground.
And
cover,
the wildfires. So. Somebody told me that like the fires that were so intense that like the geologists who were studying it actually in advance of the flood said that it was like, it was just a fine powder. But there was something like an inch of rain fell in 20 minutes, which is like four times the rate necessary to cause a flood. And one of the worst arteries, there's a little creek that's almost always dry about a quarter mile from the Westmont campus. But like that happens to be a particularly large watershed. And it just collected this huge amount of water that went down. I mean, that happens in three or four creeks sort of dotting the Montecito area. I mean, I guess everybody's seen pictures. So it's obviously a somber time here. This episode will drop hopefully soon. We're recording on Wednesday, January 17th. We're going to try to get this out later today or tomorrow. Pray for our community. Pray for first responders who are just exposed to, I mean, the most horrific kinds of scenes and the most demanding kind of work. Pray for survivors. It's a miracle that some of these stories that you're hearing about some of these survivors are really miraculous, but then it's also kind of sobering to remember that for every survivor, they undoubtedly themselves are experiencing horrific losses of their own as people were, as families were literally ripped apart. Two children in my son's elementary school were lost. One child was very deeply affected and rescued. Pray for our community. This will figure into one of the things that I'm going to talk about as a low point, so maybe we'll get back to it. But we're halfway into January, but we still wanted to do a kind of a year-in-review episode. Our recording schedule has obviously been hampered by all the crazy things going on, at least on my end, as well as the normal things going on with the holiday. So we've been planning to do a year-in-review episode for some time. It's just taken to January 17th to get around to it. And our plan for today is just to kind of go back and forth doing highs and lows. Do you guys do highs and lows at your dinner table, Coyle?
We mostly eat at our dinner table, Ed.
I guess. How old is your son?
I have one that's 3 and one that's 1. Okay. So it's largely containing the mess and trying to keep them strapped into their chairs and what have you.
Yeah. Well, you can look forward to many happy hours of talking about highs and lows at the dinner table. So with that said, I don't know, Cole, should we stick off with highs or lows for 2017?
And then let's stick off with lows and end with the highs. Although I don't know about your list, but certainly on my list, there's a lot of them that sort of fit both categories.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know exactly how we want to do that. But I mean, certainly lows, there was a lot of I'll leave the natural disaster stuff to you. Although certainly there was a lot of that in 2017. Also,
a lot of
wildfires all over the place. I'd say one example of one thing that definitely stood out last year, to the point where we did a couple of episodes about it. There was a lot of extremist violence, kind of all over the country. So Charlottesville college campuses. I mean, that I think in anyone's book has to be kind of a low point across the board. So that would be a low. How about you? Or do you want to do sort of a cluster of these from each of us?
Well, I'll chime in on that. I mean, I have things that are kind of clustered together. So I would say all the immigration stuff at the beginning of the year and Trump's executive order banning immigrants from certain countries and the chaos, and a little bit more generally just the anti-immigrant sentiment that has been a defining characteristic of all of last year. And then, look, this just happened last week. I guess that's 2018. But Trump's comments about immigration that happened last week is sort of culmination of all of that in some ways. I always get confused. Is nadir high point or low point? That's like one of these words that's always been.
There's the nadir and the apogee, right? I think.
Yeah,
I think
apogee is high, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, I think
so. Nadir must be low.
Here's low point.
Well, so I would say that's the low point. And then also in that category, I mean, include that stuff that you were talking about, specifically the Charlottesville incident. I guess we did an episode on that, no?
We've done a couple of,
which was particularly personal for me, given the fact that I grew up in that area and went to grad school at the University of Virginia. And a little bit more generally, the rise of white nationalism, obviously there's always been that kind of racist sentiment in our country. You know what I did? You had asked me about my Christmas break.
This is before the episode.
When we were just chatting before the episode. My family, we flew out to the East Coast and spent time with my wife and my respective families. We were in D.C., your old stomping grounds. Yeah. And we went to the Museum of African American History. Have you gone to that?
I haven't. I don't think it had opened when I left, just opened.
Yeah, and I'm even trying to remember when it opened, but I don't think it's more than 2 or 3 years old.
No, definitely not. They were working on it for sure, but
yeah. It is quite an extraordinary thing. The building is really, really striking. It's right at the foot of the Washington Monument. It's a beautiful, richly symbolic building in its design and in its location. And the design of the exhibit itself is it's really, really striking. You start by you enter on ground floor, you go into a basement, and then you actually take an elevator 3 stories below ground. And the exhibit starts 3 stories below ground with an exhibit focusing on slavery in the Atlantic slave trade starting in the 16th century.
And, right.
It's harrowing and striking, but then you spiral up and sort of go through slavery in the United States, the Civil War, Jim Crow, Reconstruction and Jim Crow, the Civil Rights Movement, and you're sort of spiraling upwards as you're going through.
Sort of the opposite of the Holocaust Museum then.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, that's exactly right, which I haven't been to. Have you been to the Holocaust
Museum? I have been, only once, but everyone should go once.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's an extraordinary, the exhibits were extraordinary. And the way they structure the narrative is extraordinary. But anyway, so all of that, like that rise of racist sentiment is to me, I mean, probably the most defining characteristic of 2017.
Right. And I would certainly agree with you with putting the anti-immigrant mentality into the negative column. The travel ban stuff, yeah, I think I agree with you on that. I don't know enough about the ins and outs of it to have, I guess, a fully formed opinion on whether or not, you know, Trump's banning slowing down immigration from all of those countries that Obama had previously slowed down or banned immigration from was a good thing or a bad thing. I'm not up enough on that, but certainly the general mentality of immigrants being bad, that's not good. I suppose I don't know if I'm an unusual conservative in that sense or not, in that I tend to be largely pro-immigration, pro-legal immigration anyway, but pro-immigration nonetheless. Mm-hmm. Anything else on, or is it my turn again?
Yeah, I mean, with regard to that, there isn't really any sort of defining normative commitment amongst conservatisms that would sort of naturally suggest that. And in fact, I mean, if you're among the more, I guess you can imagine, a more nationalist kind of conservative is obviously going to sort of fall into that camp. But there are libertarians who are like very pro-immigration just because they think that it's national borders are unjust inhibitions on people's freedom of movement.
Oh yeah, I don't agree with that at all. But yeah, I am pro-legal immigration, and I think it's and I suppose we should do an episode on this. It is one job of the government that conservative and liberal alike, perhaps excluding libertarians, can agree on, that it's the job of the government to secure the border. Right. I mean, I don't know a a reasonable, thoughtful person who could possibly disagree with that, which is not the same thing as being anti-immigrant, right? I mean, to say that the government should keep the border secure is not the same thing as saying no one should ever be allowed to cross it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, you and I have managed to get through the most anti-immigrant year in recent memory without doing an immigration episode. We should probably remedy that pretty quickly in 2018.
I think that sounds like a great idea.
Okay. So that is, yeah, so I guess I'm just chiming in with you. All of that stuff, all of that anti-immigrant stuff, white nationalist sentiment, for me really culminating in the Charlottesville clash is certainly like the darkest thing about 2017 for me.
Right.
Natural disasters notwithstanding. Anyways, what's next for you, Coyle?
So we've had some conversation about this on the Facebook page. The influence of Trump on the media, both in terms of its effect on things like journalistic integrity, and in terms of its its general reporting on even non-Trump related stuff, how much that's dominated by Donald Trump, I think is definitely a negative. That includes, so there's this, I'm sure you've seen this book that's come out, this Fire and Fury, which I have not read. Have you read it, Ed?
Oh, no. I mean, I a portion of it was excerpted in New York Magazine. I didn't even read that.
I did read that.
Oh, you did? I did read stories about the author. Funny thing, apparently there's a book called Fire and Fury that's a totally different book that's like now rocketed up to like top 10 in Amazon sales.
Yeah, it's like a World War II history by this Canadian professor.
Yeah, that's exactly, yeah, so, which is totally awesome. I think I'm going to publish a book called Fire and Fury that's like about my, it's a personal memoir about the Thomas Fire and the mudslide here, and see if
honestly,
I can make some money off of that.
You and I should put together a one-page ebook on Amazon, self-published.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's great, but we're going to sell it for like $50.
Oh, no. Let's not be greedy. $2-3. That's even if we only sell 50,000 of them. I mean, come on. How much is that? How much? That's several. I don't know if that's my mortgage or not. I guess I'm not that good at math, but I mean, that's something. I should write that down. That's a great idea. The
things to do in 2018.
Yeah. The point of bringing that book up is I read the New York Mag article and I was like, look, all of this stuff sounds true, but I'm also the sort of person who doesn't like Trump, so of course it's going to sound true, mm-hmm. right? And being able to sort of sort through that objectively and somewhat rationally is getting more and more difficult because the default assumption is increasingly conservative sources that like Trump are going to just never believe anything negative about him. Liberal sources that don't like Trump or conservative sources that don't like Trump are never going to believe anything good about him. And again, that I think is devastating in a society that relies so much on the media. I thought of this specifically before we'd even talked about doing this episode, back when the Harvey Weinstein news broke.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the wife and I were watching some of the late night shows the day or two after that, Colbert and Seth Meyer and so on. And both of them talked about Harvey Weinstein and how terrible this was and how good it is that this is coming to light and women are finally getting a voice and so on. And then both of them explicitly tied it into the Donald Trump presidency. And I think both of them said something to the effect of this is the sort of thing we should expect in a culture, framed by people like Donald Trump. And look, I don't disagree that there is a cultural connection of some kind there, but the things that Harvey Weinstein was accused of happened, decades ago? Not all of them, of course. There's certainly more recent ones, but starting decades ago. There's no reasonable way you can blame that on Donald Trump. Right? So this idea that Trump is just pervading everything in our media, in our culture, to the point where anything bad that happens must somehow be his fault.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's certainly symbolic of a much wider, much older problem in contemporary culture, but it's a particularly salient example, no?
Right. Well, and again, you certainly saw conservatives and Republicans doing this with Obama. It wasn't as pervasive throughout our media. So I'm going to throw that everything being Trump on my negative side of things, to the point where beyond just sort of normal liberal versus conservative media bias, media is becoming less and less valuable as their journalistic standards decline and as even the opinion stuff falls mm-hmm. into this sinkhole of Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Ed, give us another one. What do you got?
Well, no, so just to follow on both of those, that kind of gets at two things. I mean, one obvious thing is just sort of everything Trump related, and we could go through a pretty ugly litany of low points through his presidency. I got Trump fatigue pretty fast, but none of that needs to be rehashed. Sort of everything political. In that regard, like, you know, every outrageous utterance or example of his childlike ego and vanity and desire for self-glorification. So we put all of that in a box. I think we both count that as a low point. And then related to your point about news and stuff, yeah, so fake news is on my list, and I don't know if the target of my worry is exactly the same as yours, but in general, I mean, we are like in a kind of an epistemic crisis. That's like really, really, really dangerous and really complicated. I mean, driven in part by the effect of social media and the way in which it's ever easier for us to isolate ourselves so that we're exposed to news sources that that we already agree with. And even worse, just because sort of like the examples as a result of like new technologies allow ever more fringe voices to become ever more mainstream. So Alex Jones, for example, we've never talked about Alex Jones. I know almost nothing about Alex Jones. Have you seen his show at all?
I have seen
you're a subscriber to his newsletter?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I watch religiously. No, his show's like 4 hours long, right? I mean, who's got the time?
It's like
for
on
that?
YouTube. I think. It's all online.
I have seen the John Oliver bit on Alex
yeah.
Jones.
Yeah.
And that's basically the extent of my exposure to him. I've seen I have some of my Facebook friends who occasionally will share something from InfoWars, right? Is his deal.
Yeah, that's right.
So every once in a while I'll see something like that. I don't think I've ever bothered to click through and actually read or watch whatever it was. My exposure to Alex Jones is pretty limited.
But just like the way in which the internet enables extremely fringe voices to get a voice and like the proliferation of conspiracy theories, in which in the most basic kinds of facts, there's like a fundamental bifurcation. And, talking about media bias, like I think it's certainly the case that mainstream news organizations like the New York Times or the Washington Post, it's certainly the case that there's a kind of a bias here. This may be, you know, should be the subject of another episode. I think that the bias isn't always what people think that it is. I mean, it's undoubtedly the case that the people who write those are overwhelmingly liberal. But I think it's also the case that, the reporting almost always is, accurate, and it's really easy to underestimate the importance of a free active media in our country. And so like the denunciations of modern American mainstream journalistic outlets, I think is like, just gets at something extremely, extremely dangerous and unhealthy. And I don't know what the answer is with regard to sort of, addressing this, but the fact that on so many sort of basic levels, Americans can't agree on a set of facts, or the proliferation of conspiracy theories is like gets at something that's very, very troubling about the state of our union. Yeah, so those are sort of two things of mine, just everything political related to Trump and the fake news, things that are related to things that you said. What's next for you, Cole?
Yeah, so I guess to stick with Trump, at least for a little while longer, the utter chaos in the White House. At least so sort of assuming that some of these mainstream news outlets and Fire and Fury and so on are accurate. The goings on in the White House just seem to be completely out of control, because of either complete lack of inexperience on the part of everyone involved, or apathy, or reveling in the chaos, or who knows what the reason for it is. Now that's not to say that it has necessarily spilled over into the executive branch as a whole, but you still don't particularly want to see the most important office in the country devolve into what it appears to have devolved into. So, yeah, that's definitely on my list of negatives.
Mm-hmm. My next one is something that we haven't talked about. We haven't talked about Roy Moore. The Roy Moore debacle is, it's both a high and a low in some ways. Like, I don't know what would have happened if he had won. To me, it isn't just about Roy Moore. I mean, we could have a conversation about that I kind of really don't want to have. But to me, it just sort of, that is more emblematic of just the state of American Christendom or the state of American evangelical Christendom. And for viewers at home, I just did the air quotes around evangelical. And so the whole Roy Moore affair generated a lot of hand-wringing, both sort of inside and outside of American Christianity, just about the way in which Roy Moore sort of consistently got extraordinarily robust support from so-called American evangelicals. And that's really disturbing to me and sort of highlights the way in which there's a large segment of the American population that counts itself as Christian, that counts itself as evangelical or born again, but really I think is some species of religious nationalist and has no connection or genuine commitment to the gospel of Jesus Christ, right? The gospel of the Son of God who comes to save the world and redeem the world, who died and suffered on a cross. So that's a huge negative for me that comes out of last year.
He lost, so presumably it's not solely in the negative column.
Well, yeah, so that's a good thing, but it just raises that as a phenomenon. And I suppose sort of one further good thing about that is that it's led to a lot of hand-wringing, both inside and outside of American evangelicaldom, just about what American evangelicalism is. And lots of really good articles. A friend of mine who is a professor of religious studies at UVA, Chuck Matthews, had an op-ed in the Washington Post talking about these things. Another friend, or maybe in some ways a little bit more of a Facebook acquaintance, Amy Sullivan, wrote a similar kind of an article for, I guess it was the New York Times Magazine, describing what she called Fox evangelicalism. I think sort of one good thing about it is that it's led to like lots of really sober reflection about the state of things, that I think forcing people to sort of clarify what exactly their understanding of what it is to be a Christian is, whether this label of evangelicalism is something that we want to fight for and preserve and draw a line denounce people, many of whom are pretty prominent American evangelicals, and say, no, that's right. That's not all right. You have drifted. you know, there were all of those pastors who came out in support of Roy Moore.
Well, sort of. The list that he released was apparently not entirely accurate.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. So some of the people on the list had like originally supported him way back before anyone knew who he was, and he was running for judge or whatever it was, whatever his first office was. And some of the people had not actually supported him at all. And some of the people had asked to be taken off the list, but they hadn't been. I mean, yeah. So it was kind of a mess.
Did Jerry Falwell Jr. pronounce on matters Roy Moore? I can't remember. I seem to vaguely remember him.
I can't imagine he did.
Yeah, I seem to vaguely remember a statement in support. But anyways, that was 2017 was a really, really big year for American evangelicals, I think, in ways that were disturbing, but hopefully also in ways that are going to lead to kind of reflection about what it means about Christianity and empire and power.
And I'll go ahead and go on record as agreeing with you that Roy Moore should not have been a senator. I cannot speak to the specific allegations made against him. I didn't follow the story that closely. But frankly, his actions as a judge should have disqualified him from being a senator. So yeah, I which isn't to say I'm nuts about the radically pro-choice guy they elected in his place, but it was in some ways a little picture of the 2016 presidential election, and that there was not really a good candidate on the ballot that you could have voted for, I think, in good conscience.
Yeah. So what's next for you?
Still doing negatives. We will get to positives.
In the last 5 minutes.
No. I've got a lot of positives too. So the utter collapse of whatever was left of congressional leadership in action, I think, has really been discouraging in 2017. Going into 2017, I think I said this on an episode way back in 2016. You know, I would have said, you know, we have great congressional leadership. You know, Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell are, I think I said in the past, they're the best leaders we've had in Congress since Tip O'Neill in the early 80s.
I don't know if I would disagree with you, but that, my friend, is the definition of damning with faint praise.
Well, yeah, there's that. There's certainly some ways in which that's still kind of true, but it's been a really disappointing year in that sense. I mean, the Republican hypocrisy, of course, again, relative to Trump. I mean, we've talked about that kind of to death in 2016. The idea that Republicans would support someone like that after spending the entire 90s denouncing a president because of his personal character is discouraging, certainly. But the fact that congressional leadership has not done a great job of actually leading Congress. Now, I don't know how much of that is because it's not possible to lead Congress given its current makeup, but it still is something that it's not entirely encouraging to watch. And the specific example of this is the tax bill, right? That went through so many I don't know how many drafts of that thing were there before they finally passed something. I don't even remember now at this point.
I don't know either, but I do know that the Senate floor vote happened with just a day of discussion using a draft of the final version that had handwritten notes scribbled in the margin.
I'll try to fact check this and correct this on the Facebook page, but I believe that was not the final version of the tax bill. I think that particular version of the tax bill had some kind of errors in it that meant they had to go back and do it again.
That's probably true, but that was the one right before the vote.
That's the one that made the news, but that's not the actual thing that they finally passed. So the one that they finally passed was, I believe, yet another version of it. But the point of all of this is that the process was not great. It's a process that Mitch McConnell in his memoir specifically condemned and then turned around and used on this tax bill. The behind closed doors, meaningless debate on the floor where amendments are not allowed, especially in the Senate. In the House, you sort of expect that sort of thing just because of the size of the House and the regular rules of the House. That's not by McConnell's own admission. That's not how the Senate's supposed to work. And yet that's still what he did. So again, that Republican hypocrisy there, and just the sloppy content, rather than taking time to do it right, taking time to slow down and get things right, getting it through quickly rather than getting it through correctly. Now the tax bill will make my list of positives too, but, at least in terms of the way it was done, it definitely needs to be in the negative column. Republicans need to be held accountable for that.
You know, I don't disagree with what you said, obviously. I suppose one thing that I have, though, is that, like, it's easy to sort of romanticize the past and kind of imagine this, you know, the good old days of the Republic in which people would get together and have serious and sober debates about these things in plain view of everybody. But I also wonder the extent to which, like, how much of that is actually the reality of the history of our country from the beginning?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there have always been behind the scenes deals. That's fine. I don't object to that. But it's also been the case that often was not sort of the end of the story. I can't say never, but it, you know, there is still an openness even about the behind the scenes deals where they'll cut the deal behind the scene and then come out and say, hey, this is the deal we've cut. And because it's a deal usually involving both parties, everyone is at least somewhat okay with it. Again, not a universal rule, but in general. And especially with, you know, things like things that used to be normal, like your budget, right? You might have more pushback on special bills, on declarations of war, on those sorts of things. But when it's something that you have to do every year, that's when maybe it's a little less common.
Mm-hmm. To piggyback on that, I mean, you were going to say the tax bill is, well, that you thought the tax cut itself anyways was a good thing. I guess I would just say that one of my negatives for 2017, just sort of all of this legislation, budget related, related to the healthcare bill legislation, that to my mind has been largely architected by billionaire libertarian financiers, entirely at the expense of the most vulnerable and disadvantaged in our country. And that, you know, so there are Medicare cuts that are going around various state houses. Obamacare has basically been gutted, and I'm not even exactly sure about how it's going to survive after the defunding of certain programs. The tax cut, I think is going to be disastrous for the federal deficit and debt, as well as ultimately cutting programs that help support like the most needy of people. And so from my perspective anyways, like all of that legislation has basically sort of sacrificed the neediest of people in our country in favor of those who have benefited the most.
In favor of 80% of Americans.
80% of Americans are getting tax cuts. But obviously, those tax cuts are going to most benefit the top 10% or even the top. I mean, they really are specially crafted in some ways to most benefit the wealthiest 1% of Americans.
Who are not getting as much of a tax cut, if any, depending on where they live.
So I wasn't necessarily in a position to sort of go full bore detail on this, but why am I totally blanking on the language? The corporate income tax cut from 35% to 20%.
Right.
I mean, that in some ways is a controversial thing. Something that a lot of progressives have looked into. Because it is the case that that corporate taxation rate in the United States is like it's the highest in the developing world, and there's some reasons to think that it inhibits American productivity. And so even Obama had floated the idea of doing something with that tax rate, but in ways that would ultimately be revenue neutral. But one of the effects of that is that we're going to see exactly what happens, but one of the ways in which that might happen is it's going to generate greater dividend distributions that are going to help the kind of people who own taxes. So that's one thing. There is an income tax cut from the highest bracket, right? Of like 1.5%.
Yeah, it's smaller than the lower brackets, mm-hmm. but there is a cut there. The trade off is, and I guess, well, since we're on it, might as well throw out my positives on it. The trade off for that is if you live in a state with a high income tax, that's, I forget if your state income taxes are no longer deductible at all, or if you can only deduct a portion of them. I forget exactly how that works.
It's the latter.
If you're living in, you know, New York, California, Connecticut, New Jersey, places where the wealthy tend to live, your taxes will either go up or with that tax drop stay the same because you can no longer write off as much of it. I don't know that it's quite neutral. I don't know that there's no change for the taxes on the wealthy because I'm not a, you know, tax accountant or CPA, but it's also not just a simple tax cut. And honestly, I don't know that I care about the corporate tax at all. It is high, and I suppose it should come down. It's a corporate tax. I'm likely never to have to pay it other than when I buy stuff, you know, from a corporation. I'm much more interested in the tax bill taking steps to, if it stays on the trajectory it's on, eventually lead to the death of the estate tax. The sooner that dies, the happier I'll be.
Because you think it's immoral.
I think it is inherently unjust and utterly devastating. Especially it's what, like a 50% tax. I mean, it's taxing something that has been taxed for the entire life of the person who owned it, taxing it that high after they die, I think is immoral. Taxing it all after they die, I think is immoral, but especially taxing it that high. And I understand the arguments in favor of it. You know, when Bill Gates dies, I understand that the government wants a chunk of that money. And I understand that you're not actually, you know, doing his heirs any substantive damage, when you instead of inheriting $80 billion, they only inherit $40 billion or whatever. I realize their lives won't be any different. But those aren't the people it's devastating to. It's the people who own small farms or small plots of land that have large cash value, but don't have any money themselves. Those are the people who are seriously injured by the estate tax. So, and it needs to go.
So, I mean, it's worth pointing out, right, that the families that fall into those scenarios that's a pretty small minority. And it's always possible to craft the estate tax in such a way that it's going to spare those kinds of small family farmers.
Well, it's not just the family farmers, right? So the individual who owns a house in urban DC, uh-huh. right? That house might have a book value of several million uh-huh. dollars. That doesn't mean that person is worth several million mm-hmm. dollars just because of the way land prices have gone in DC. So it's not just a rural problem, right? It's an urban problem.
Yeah, sure. So that's fine, but I mean, that house wouldn't be subject to an estate tax unless that house was worth
DC property prices.
Well, yeah, but many millions of dollars, right? But in any case, I was just going to say this: I don't think that there is anything inherently unjust in an estate tax, and then we could have a conversation about the nature of property rights, which I guess we've kind of had before. I guess I would just say this: I mean, to me, it's a largely pragmatic issue. I mean, one other thing with the estate tax is that there's this worry that it just creates a kind of a tiered society, and allowing the accumulation of generational wealth like that inevitably leads to political inequality. But I mean, to me, the bigger, more salient point of discussion just has to do with the pragmatic issue. So like the government budget is a certain amount of money. So there's just certain responsibilities that I think the government ought to have, and that adds up to particular amount of money. We could have a debate about what that number is, but then that means that the government needs to obtain those funds through taxation. And then to me, it's just a question of designing like the most efficient, developing the most efficient tax system. And so if an economist told me that, there are more efficient ways of doing it, then that's just fine. Or if you want to get rid of the estate tax and make up with it in some other kind of way, that's like fine with me. But inevitably, that's not the way it's done. It's just cutting taxes.
Right. And I should also say, I agree with you on the, on your deficit point. I think there, the budget did not do a good enough job, as much as I appreciate the tax cuts. The budget did not do a good enough job of cutting spending. Like you can't just cut taxes. You also have to cut spending. And, I think that's something that we have not done well in a very long time, in part because Americans are so addicted to federal money. And that's, you know, maybe a discussion for another day, but you can't just cut the income. You also have to cut the outflow.
Yeah. And, you know, government taxation as a percentage of GDP is like lower than it's been in generations. It's not like the federal budget as a percentage of GDP has wildly grown. What has wildly changed is like the rates of taxation. Like rates of taxation are historically low. They just are historically low. Like I've been meaning to look this up as a project, but if you look at like the mean or the median tax rate over the 20th century, it's considerably higher than what it is now.
Right. Particularly when we're at war, right? I mean, that's...
Yeah, but you can even factor out the war years and it's still considerably higher. The tax rates in the 20th century for the uppermost income, I mean, they're up in like 60-70%. Running up a deficit is a slightly complicated thing, I think. And it sometimes tends to get simplified by like comparisons to family budget spending, right. Which it's not anything like, you know, a federal government isn't anything like a family. One thing about federal deficit spending is, or federal debt is that because it extends so far in the future and because inflation is, a kind of a reality, like that money is actually, it's getting cheaper in the future. But in any case, like I'm the kind of progressive who's something of a deficit hawk.
Right.
Because the fact of the matter is that like when the debt grows to a certain point, then it does start to affect people's economic welfare. And ultimately that's going to get paid off by, you know, by our kids.
Or military conquest when we can't pay our debts.
That's historically been the way that we roll.
For what it's worth, I'm on board with you on that. I'm something of a deficit hawk as well. I am not inherently against deficit spending. I'm against a $21 trillion debt. And I'm also not against a progressive tax rate. I mean, I don't have a problem with that either, which is not the same thing as saying that I, you know, think our taxes are too low, but I'm just not against the tiered system that we use.
So why are you excited about the tax cut then?
Because I think our taxes are too high. I'm not against, when I say, I guess I say progressive, I mean, I'm not against, you know, taxing wealthy people at a higher rate. Maybe progressive is not the right word there, but I'm not against, you know, different tax brackets where you pay different percentages on your income or whatever. That's fine. I have no objection to that. For the reasons that I talked about earlier, where if your income is $100 million a year, no damage is done to you if you know, $20 million of that is taken away. Your lifestyle does not change at all. Whereas if your income is, you know, $10,000 a year, $2,000 of that being taken away is devastating. So
we're not going to be able to have a whole full-blown conversation here, but why do you think tax rates are too high when they're historically low?
They are historically low. But that doesn't mean that they were, you know, right in the past either. So again, I think 70% is, you know, higher than I'm necessarily comfortable with. Yeah. With the understanding that the other side of that, I'm also against how much we spend. So again, it's not like I'm, you know, just cut the taxes and we'll make it up with, you know, going in deeper into debt. Like it's not, you got to cut both sides of it. But yes, that might be a longer conversation than we have time for here.
Yeah. Well, anyways, to me, I mean, the last time the deficit was actually shrinking was during the Clinton administration, in which
it was.
They raised taxes. Spending went up a little bit, but they raised taxes and paid down the debt, and that led to low interest rates.
They made the last year of Clinton, first year of Bush, they made the intentional decision not to pay off the deficit. And instead, well, you probably remember this, right? To return the surplus to the American people was Bush's big thing.
Yeah.
Rather than using it to pay off the debt, just because we wanted to keep our credit rating as a nation. Now, of course, 18 years later, that doesn't look like such a great idea. But at the time, the economic powers that be made that particular choice.
Yeah, I didn't think that was such a good idea back then.
I was 17, 18 when it happened. I don't remember what I thought, but it was probably stupid.
We should jog along to the next thing.
Yeah. So one of the negatives, and I have this both on the negative and the positive list is the left getting a taste of its own medicine. Specifically thinking in terms of an administration that is willing to just sort of pursue its own policy, even if it's not always sure what that policy is, and even if it is in some kind of chaos, pursue its own policy without any regard whatsoever to what the other side is doing. That's a positive, because after 8 years of Obama, I don't mind the other side getting some of that, but it's also a negative because that shouldn't happen to anyone. We're occasionally seeing, you know, the equivalent of the Dear Colleague letter from the Obama administration that we did an episode on concerning transgendered bathrooms in high schools. I think that shouldn't happen at all, but I don't mind it going both ways if it is going to happen. So, yeah, positive and a negative, both, mostly a negative, I think.
I'm tempted to push back on that, but I will yield the floor to the distinguished gentleman from Missouri.
Fair enough. What do you got, Ed? Give us one of your negatives.
Well, so an obvious one for me, just the natural disasters around our country and around the world. I hesitate. I mean, I'm certainly going to leave some off, but there were the hurricanes affecting the Caribbean and Florida and Texas. I guess that's Irma, Harvey, and Maria, led to, you know, just devastation that people are still recovering from. There were forest fires in Northern California, around in the wine country and around Santa Clara that were just totally devastating. And then obviously on a very personal note, the Thomas fire in my backyard here, and then followed by the debris flow and mudslides that followed. It's almost like the earth is getting warmer.
Well, yeah, all those fires.
Fire comes from somewhere. Anyway, so that is, and I think I read that like the economic cost of natural disasters in 2017 had hit, I mean, not just an all-time high, but was like, you know, orders of magnitude over the last, it's like these natural disasters are growing more frequent and more intense. Were there really bad wildfires up in your old neck of the woods in Montana this past year too?
440,000 acres burned. I don't know if that's average or slightly more than average, but it's such a dry state. The American West gets fires fairly often. I think what's I think what was unusual this year was how long they burned. So not necessarily the amount, but the well, maybe it was the amount also. Again, I don't know. So yeah, I mean it's but that's you know, every year there are fires in the West. This year it seems that they were a little bit worse, although I'm not sure exactly in what way.
That gives you a sense of the scale. So you said 440,000 acres. I think the Thomas fire burned. Well, it was in excess of 120, because I think 120,000 was the old record. So the Montana fires were like four times the size of that. But I guess one difference is that like it's a lot more populated down here than it is up there.
Right. And I mean, I guess I don't know exactly what the terrain is there, but the parts of Montana that burn tend to be grassland. And I mean, they just go in an instant, especially with the wind, like between being dry and windy. They're in some ways much harder to fight than forest or household fires, because they're so fast.
Here it's like chaparral and brush on mountainsides, basically. And it burns hot and more intensely.
Right. And they're really hard to get to there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when they happen in the back country, it's not necessarily a problem. But when they happen in the front country, it's obviously a big problem.
Sure.
How about you next?
So this is my last negative, which like some of my others is also in the positive category. The hashtag MeToo movement, which we saw kick off with Harvey Weinstein, right? He was sort of the one who got the ball rolling on this, if I remember correctly. So obviously that's a positive in that, you know, there are women who have been, or men in some cases, who have been, sexually harassed, sexually assaulted. I think that being able to get some kind of justice, for those individuals is obviously a good thing. Encouraging reflection on what that actually looks like, I think is also a good thing. So we've seen some soul searching sort of across the society on this, all of that's in the positive category. In the negative category, of course, things like the lack of due process, the idea that just being accused of something is now enough to destroy someone's life, that I think is incredibly problematic. We've seen examples of people, you know, be falsely accused. I think that that certainly belongs in the negative category. I'd say kind of my thought on the thing overall is every accusation of sexual harassment should be fully, seriously, and intensely investigated, and then, if necessary, prosecuted to whatever the fullest extent of the law is. I get a little bit nervous when Twitter warriors take over and fight this in their own way. That I think is again on that sort of negative side, although not to ignore the positives.
Yeah, so I think the actual hashtag MeToo started well in advance of the Harvey Weinstein thing. And so there was that whole thing on Facebook and Twitter in which people were just talking about having experienced sexual harassment. But obviously the real culmination of the intensity of attention to the movement and to the problem happened with Weinstein.
Right.
When was that? Was that in November?
Yeah,
it wasn't even...
It's been recent. It was during the Alabama election, right, or shortly after?
Yeah, sometime around there. So say, well, November-ish.
Right.
And, you know, the speed and the power of that movement, it's not to say that all of a sudden everything is better, but like you almost never see cultural change happening that quickly. It's really an extraordinary thing. And
not an unfettered good, although a partial good.
I mean, I would say it's pretty close to being an unfettered good insofar as it's caused a total reevaluation of the kind of behavior that's appropriate, that's appropriate between people, men, women, whatever. I see your point about being falsely accused. I would say that there's a difference between, I mean, there's obviously a difference between criminal prosecution or even a civil trial of some kind and accusations that are going on Twitter. Not to say that those accusations are totally cost-free, but I mean, there's a way in which I think those conversations, I don't know if I can think of a big social media blow up that I thought, and I'm probably not thinking very hard, that I thought was totally inappropriate. And I think that on occasion, like, those conversations can actually be really, really thoughtful. And so I have in mind, this is a 2018 thing, but the thing that just happened with Aziz Ansari,
right?
Which was complicated in a lot of ways. And certainly there were really sort of sour old voices saying that this is all just political correctness gone awry. But, you know, there was kind of a split reaction amongst like old school and new school feminists that I thought was really interesting.
Sure.
And I think it engendered a lot of really like thoughtful conversation on the politics of sexual relationships and things like that. And,
oh yeah.
You know, his nose was bloodied in that, but I don't think, I don't think it was overly bloodied, and I think it really engendered an interesting kind of conversation about sexual politics.
But was it justly bloodied?
So it's not. I think it almost certainly was.
Okay.
I think there's no reason to think that things didn't happen more or less substantially as he was accused. And like, you know, and the woman was criticized by a lot of like feminist critics for the post, or at least some, I should say. But there's no reason to think that things didn't happen more or less as she said it did. And I mean, I don't know. There are all kinds of complicated issues with regard to privacy and the expectations of what it is to be a celebrity. And look, it obviously sucks to be Aziz Ansari the day after that. But I don't know. I don't know that it was unjustly bloodied. I certainly don't think Harvey Weinstein was, his nose was unjustly bloodied. And, you know, and all of those public social media pronouncements like lead to criminal investigations where appropriate, which I think is a really good thing. There's the crazy thing with the U.S. gymnastics physician.
Right.
It like the extent to which light has been shown on all of this so quickly, and the way in which expectations have so quickly been scrutinized, is it's kind of a remarkable thing. You just like, and obviously it's not like sexual harassment or assault is going to instantly change, but there's just a way in which like our culture, you know, particularly kind of a macho masculine culture, like not only tolerated a certain way of talking about and behaving and expectations with regard to women, but even encouraged it. And it's like a really remarkable thing, I think, in a lot of ways, that like those assumptions have been totally questioned.
Yeah, and well, you talked about some of the discussions that have been going on within feminism. Some of the discussions there have included questions like going back and even reexamining, say, the sexual revolution, right? Perhaps consent is not a sufficient, reason to have relations between two people. Which, as someone who holds a traditionalist sexual ethic, I would say absolutely, right? I completely agree with that statement. And here's a possible alternative, which of course is not exactly what the feminists are looking for, but it does. Again, that's I think there are all of those positives. On the other side, again, my concern is going to be with the negative. So I'm thinking specifically about I don't know if you followed the issue with Margaret Atwood.
You know, I didn't. I vaguely saw her name. I vaguely saw her name in print, but
yeah, I mean, basically, there was an issue at the University of, I think, University of British Columbia, I think, Canadian University of some sort, where this professor had been dismissed, and she joined with some others in saying, well, wait a second, what about some kind of due process here? Mm-hmm. This entire thing has been secretive. Now, because it was secretive, maybe there was due process. We don't know. But her point was, look, it's you don't, from our sort of outside perspective, they jump straight to punishment. Mm-hmm. And that's not okay. Even as a feminist, I'm saying that's not okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I mean, people turned on her. Like, it was vicious the way people went after her.
Yeah.
So again, I'm not willing to say this is an unfettered good, although I also want to acknowledge, yes, there are these good things that are going along with it. And I think those good things need to be encouraged and fostered. The idea of accusation equals instant punishment, that's where we need to say, well, wait a second.
Oh,
wait,
sure.
Wait.
Sure.
And well, it's probably been too long now. I also remember the Rolling Stone article about UVA, right? About the fraternity at UVA.
Yeah.
Just completely untrue, like completely fabricated on the part of the person they interviewed.
Yeah.
I don't know how much damage that did to that particular fraternity, but I imagine it wasn't none.
Or
to UVA as a whole. So
yeah, absolutely.
Which again is where I come back to any allegation, any accusation should be seriously and thoroughly investigated and appropriate steps taken afterwards, but probably not before.
Yeah. So that was your last negative, was it?
That's my last negative. Do you have any others?
Can I get to my last negative?
Give it to us.
Which is going to be truly divisive. I actually don't know if you're going to agree with me, strongly disagree with me and hang up the call on me, or just give me a blank stare of disinterest. But to me, one of the worst negatives of 2017, occurring right towards the end of the year, was the Star Wars movie, which was an abomination.
You know, I I'm still thinking about that. It's, I think I liked it. It wasn't as bad as the three prequels.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I know many of the people I know who didn't like it, who went back and saw it a second time, said they liked it more the second time. So yeah, I thought it was fine, but I'm also not a Star Wars purist. So
yeah. So on the geek scale, where 10 is you dress up in a Yoda outfit to go see the latest movie, where are you on the Star Wars geek scale?
Oh, 3.
Okay.
2. I mean, I think it's kind of interesting, but I'm just slightly younger than the Star Wars generation. So I, I watched it for the first time on VHS. So I mean, it's not like it wasn't a big
VHS,
reveal.
Not Netflix.
Yeah. 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 It wasn't a big reveal as to who was whose father and so on. So
I would say that I'm a 7 about. I wouldn't dress up for sure. But like, you know, I remember 1970. I was 5 years old. And I remember that. I remember the opening scroll like it was yesterday. And so there's a way in which I'm invested in this.
And my generation doesn't have a movie like that. Like we don't. There's no equivalent for us. Mm-hmm. The Harry Potter books are probably the closest, the books.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so with all of that said, and with the abomination discussed, maybe we can turn and talk about a few happy things that might have happened in 2017.
Yeah, do you want me to go first on that?
I'll kick us off. So I have the Me Too movement under this category. That is kind of an exciting thing. There's been pretty positive economic growth over the last few years coming out of the Great Recession. That is a good thing. I think there's a way in which, you know, those are just numbers, but those numbers mean things for people, right? The unemployment rate is creeping down. But even with that said, you know, it's not like the economic growth is being shared equally by everyone. And there are worries about the stagnation of wages that continue to be a problem. But I would say overall, continued economic growth in 2017 is a good, my first good. How about you, Mr. Neil?
I have been encouraged by, and I think I've said this on the show before, I've been encouraged by how many postmoderns out there have rediscovered truth in the wake of Trump. I think I mentioned even this specifically. Nathan Gilmore went to some kind of get together of podcasters in California, where many of them.
I was at that one.
What's that?
Yeah, that was. I was at that.
Yeah,
one.
Yeah,
I was
yeah. At that's right. That's right. I saw the pictures of that.
The homebrewed. Yes. The Homebrew Christianity Conference.
Yes. So, yeah, that I think is fairly typical of what's been going on in sort of the postmodern world, where you have these people who for, you know, years or decades have been saying truth is relative, truth is relative, truth is relative. Along comes Donald Trump with his alternative facts, and all of a sudden truth is no longer relative. Truth is now an absolute, and he doesn't have it. So that I think is sort of a philosophical good that's happening out there. Even if I disagree with sort of where they're ending up, at least there's some kind of movement. Perhaps a minor good, but it's still, I think a good, do you want me to do another one or do you have?
Sure. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I'd sort of, lump into that. We'll call this our cluster of rediscovering things. The left has largely been rediscovering things like procedure, federalism and states' rights. So I think that's a good, again, I think this is largely relative to Trump. But the idea that maybe states should be able to tell the federal government no, and that different layers of government matter, and that process matters. Those are all things that we've seen make a big comeback. Seeing sort of Chuck Schumer out on the stump, talking about how the Senate has rules that matter now that, you know, the other side is in charge. So, which of course you had the Republicans doing the same thing when they were in the minority. There's some of that that's just politics, but I like to think that some of it is genuine too. Ed, give us another positive.
The decline of ISIS. That I think is a good. That's something that recently I've seen some Trump people trumpeting as a great success. And I gather that there has been a kind of a military restructuring going on that has enabled some of those successes. But I guess I would also note that the tide had turned even in 2016. But given the existential threat that ISIS was, I mean, look, things are obviously still extraordinarily chaotic in that part of the world. But at least their decline in power is something that is obviously a good thing.
Yeah, and I don't have mixed thoughts on the decline of ISIS. That's a good thing. I have mixed thoughts on the United States' involvement in that, in part because part of Trump's campaign was, you know, not getting us involved in foreign conflicts. And, mm-hmm. you know, shortly after becoming president, we were, you know, bombing ISIS camps in Syria, or possibly Syrian camps in Syria. I'm not entirely sure. And I don't know that Trump is entirely.
Russian camps in Syria.
I'm not entirely sure the administration knew either. So do they get credit for that? Well, I don't know. But they certainly don't get credit for campaigning on, we're not going to do this, and then immediately doing it. So yeah, it's good that ISIS has rolled back to wherever it's rolled back to. The procedure of getting us there, right? That's where I would sort of raise questions. Related to that, though, I guess I'd put as a positive some of the ridiculous executive actions from the Obama administration that Trump has rolled back. Again, we mentioned the transgendered letter to our nation's schools. We've talked extensively about the Obama assault on coal that has been rolled back, although to no effect because, of course, the damage was done. The stepping out of the not the Kyoto protocols. What's the one we left? Paris. Paris Accords, the undoing of the Iran deal. Any number of these. And again, I don't know that I necessarily give Trump exactly credit for that because he gets credit for it in that he did it. I don't know that he gets sort of full credit in that I don't think he did it carefully and thoughtfully and with a full knowledge of all of the arguments on both sides. I think he signed something that some of his aides put in front of him. So positive in that it happened.
You know, the thing about the Iran thing, he didn't really, the Iran deal is still standing. He looked at it and then decided he wanted to keep it in place, but in such a way as that it didn't actually require his affirmation. Right. But the Iran deal is
still
in place.
We did not get the bribe money that we paid Iran back, right? That's gone. But yeah, and again, maybe that should drop off the list. Maybe that's something that, that shouldn't be on there, but well, give us another positive before we get bogged down too much in this issue.
We've mentioned a couple things in passing that are big negatives. Russia's influence on American politics and social life via Facebook, and possible illegal collusion with our current president's administration is a big negative. But anyways, moving on to the positives. I don't know if a lot of people noticed this. I can't remember. You know, I saw this earlier in the year, and I can't remember if I mentioned it or if we talked about it. But the teen pregnancy rate continues to drop. It dropped 9% in 2016 and 67% since 1991. Like, teen pregnancies are over cut in half since 1991. Corresponding with that is the decline in the rate of abortion. Which I think also has declined back to, I should be careful what I say here. Anyways, is historically low. And that's a pretty remarkable thing.
No, that's certainly true.
How about you, Coyle?
I mean, I think the political highlight of last year is probably Gorsuch. The addition of a surprisingly good judge to the Supreme Court. So I don't know that I would go as far as to say, as some of my friends have, that makes up for everything else from the administration, but it's certainly a weighty counterbalance. So, yeah, I would put Gorsuch it's probably one of the few things I have in the unmitigated positive category. What would be his nomination?
I'd say this about Gorsuch. So I understand why conservatives like him, obviously. And it's not like I think he's unqualified, but, you know, and we've talked about this. I think he's a bad justice.
Right.
But that's just me.
See our constitutional interpretation episode.
Yes. I'm afraid I'm all out of positives, but I see that you have one left that
I
don't quite understand. But that's because I don't watch late night television as much as you do.
Oh, yeah. So, and I should qualify this, which I don't actually watch late night television at night. It's sort of the next day streaming. We catch, an episode or two of whatever, and usually just a few minutes of it. But Saturday Night Live continues to improve. So they sort of starting early 2016 have been on an upward trajectory, largely because of their political coverage that has been fantastic. So in early 2016, late 2015, I forget which, for the first time in 7 or 8 years, they did a sketch making fun of Barack Obama. And kind of that seems to have been a breakshed point for them, where the left was once again fair game for making fun. And there's even an interview with Lorne Michaels about this, where he talked about how, you know, making fun of liberals was something they tended not to do for various reasons. But that sort of marked some kind of watershed. And of course, on the Republican side of things, they lend themselves to comedy with the particular candidates they had for president in 2016. And then with the guy who won, of course, there's a lot of material there. But they have not left off kind of making fun of both sides. So even a few weeks back, they had a good, again, their stuff on Trump has continued to be excellent. Alec Baldwin is a fantastic Trump. But a few weeks back, they did a public service announcement from the Democratic Party that was fantastic. I mean, it was just really well done. Yeah, so we'll try to remember to throw a link to that up in the notes. But Saturday Night Live, I think, has gotten a lot better, and I'm happy to put that on my list of positives.
Okay, well, as we wind down our list of our 2017 in review episode. Let me just ask you, do you think our list of positives is going to be longer or shorter for 2018?
Man, I don't even know. I like to think that I'll remember that we're going to do a year in review and keep better track of what's going on. So maybe it'll be longer. I think one of the problems with my list is, I was putting this all together, you know, in the last week. So I'm sure stuff from the early part of 2017 is just completely left off, and I'm sure it's weighted heavily towards the last 2 months. So if I actually remember to keep track along the way, then yeah, hopefully it'll be a lot longer. I don't know if it'll be longer than the negatives, but yeah. How about you? What are your hopes for 2018?
I see nothing, no big national issues aside from what we've already talked about. I mean, all my positives, I think, will be positives in 2018 as well. I mean, I think those trends are written in, and so I'm glad about that. But all of my negatives, I think, are things that I continue to be worried about: political division, lack of civility, natural disasters, racism and anti-immigrant sentiment, confusion from Christians about what matters, and bad Star Wars movies. I don't anticipate 2017 being better, and burgeoning conflict with North Korea is something that I'm worried about.
Sure.
So I am not particularly optimistic, but
I mean, we can hope that there will be no further missile attacks in Hawaii.
It's an amazing thing that something like that can happen. A colleague of mine who's a computer scientist was sort of explaining how that can happen, technically speaking. And it just basically somebody clicks send instead of save,
right,
because they're creating templates. But you think they would make it a little bit harder to do things like that.
Right. But of course, harder to do things like that means it takes longer to get the actual warning out.
Well, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And in the wake of a lot of hand-wringing about whether the evacuation notices in my part of town were as aggressive as they could have been. Yeah, there's we got a handful of false warnings about things. Well, anyways, you've been listening to yet another episode of the City of Man podcast, episode 51, which is just astonishing to me. And we're really, really grateful to all of you all for listening in. We apologize for our hiatus. Coyle and I, well, Coyle's been hard at work. I have been distracted by, you know, fires and debris slides and grading and whatnot. But Coyle and I haven't done a proper episode together in quite a long time. So we apologize for that. And we hope at least 2018 will be filled with more good episodes from Professor Neil and myself. Please do visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast or shoot us an email at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com to tell us what we should have put on our list or where we were wrong in our list, or just to give us feedback about our show. Please do like our Facebook page. Coyle and I often will sort of have banter back and forth. And if you like the page, you'll get alerts about when we posted something or are having a conversation there. Equally, we'd love it if you left a review on our iTunes page. We have a perfect 5-star rating. So, you know, only go on there if you're going to leave our 9th 5-star rating. We are proud members of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. Please check out all the other shows in the Humanist family by visiting christianhumanist.org. And as always, let me remind our listeners to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and to render unto God those things that are God's. Thanks so much for listening.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.